This program deals with themes of an adult nature and is intended for a mature audience.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
We must guard against the military-industrial complex.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
The questions you always had. The answers you were never given. The place to seek the truth. Welcome to Veritas.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
The power they took from the people will return to the people.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Shall I tell you what I find beautiful about you? You are at your very best when things are worse.
Sooner or later, though, you always have to wake up.
Be skeptical, but don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas at veritasradio.com. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home. To listen to part two of tonight's interview and all of our interviews, just go to veritasradio.com and click on the subscribe button. You'll receive your login immediately. And Sanitas Radio is already making a difference. All the guests will help us improve our health and live longer. How, you ask? Go to sanitasradio.com and find out. You cannot put a price on health. And the futuristic metal case USB drive with Season 5 is now available. Go to the Veritas store for more information. You can also purchase MMS right there. And to get in touch with us, for member support, media inquiries, you want to be a guest or are a whistleblower, there's a link for you by clicking on the contact button of our website at veritasradio.com. Tonight's interview was recorded a few weeks ago. During the interview, you will hear the guest and I discuss Lloyd Pye, the founder of the Star Child Project, his sacrifices toward changing the current paradigm, and his fight with cancer. Unfortunately, Lloyd Pye passed away on Tuesday, December the 9th, at 6:15 p.m. Central Time. Everyone at the Star Child Project was deeply saddened to hear the news. His nephew wrote, quote, "Lloyd was surrounded by family and died in his mother's arms. Thank you to all of his friends and fans for your support, prayers, and love. He loved you all deeply," unquote. Lloyd touched us all and taught all of us to think about the world in a profoundly different way. As he used to say, quote, "Not everything you know is wrong, but a heck of a lot it is," unquote. Lloyd, thank you for everything you have done for all of us, and for sharing your brilliance and your light with us. We will do everything we can to continue your legacy. I had the privilege of spending time with Lloyd last year, and tonight's interview memorializes his work. Lloyd Pye and his team chose Matthew Brownstein to continue his legacy for a reason. Rest in peace, Lloyd. Tonight's special guest is Matthew Brownstein from the Star Child Project. Coming up, right now, on Veritas. Matthew Brownstein is the newest member of the Star Child Project team, which has been working actively since 1999 to prove the mystery of a 900-year-old carbon-dated bone skull that genetic experts and medical professionals feel could very well be another species not yet known to modern science. Matthew is the chief operating officer of the Star Child Project and has joined the team to help with their fundraising efforts to raise the money to sequence the DNA of the Star Child skull. Matthew works directly with Lloyd Pye and the entire Star Child Project team to create more public awareness of a skull that could truly change history as we know it. Matthew is also the executive director of the Florida Institute of Hypnotherapy and has been in the fields of alternative therapies and alternative knowledge for over 20 years. As a hypnotherapist, he is also very familiar with the phenomena of hypnosis and alien abduction and the profound implications of what it would mean to prove alien life. And to learn more about Matthew Brownstein and the Star Child Project, visit the website starchildproject.com, which is also linked at ours. And directly from Tampa, Florida, I would like to introduce Matthew Brownstein. Hello, Matthew, and welcome to Veritas.
Hello, Mal. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, thanks for being on the show. And I know most of our listeners know what the Star Child Project is and Lloyd Pye. But for those who don't, give us the history of the Star Child Project and how you came on board as well.
Sure, I'd be happy to. As many people know, of course, Lloyd Pye has been the major spokesperson for the Star Child Project. And just to mention how I got into it, and then we'll go into the history, about a year ago, I made a donation to the Star Child Project. I was Googling around. I found starchildproject.com, and I said, my God, if this skull is the real deal, whatever this is, I need to know. And I made a donation, and Lloyd Pye was kind enough to email me back directly. And it turned out we didn't live that far from each other. And we started talking and communicating, and I said, so, you know, it's been going on since 1999. You have a 900-year-old carbon-dated bone skull that the current DNA is showing is probably not human. Where is this at? And I was just excited beyond words. After talking a little while, my background is not only in alternative therapy and alternative knowledge, but I run multiple companies, different businesses, and I realized the primary place the Star Child Project was at is they need to raise a significant amount of money to sequence the entire genome of the Star Child skull. So I said, let me come up with a plan. And let's see if the team that's currently on board, there's a bunch of people work behind the scenes, if the team likes it. Lloyd actually came to Tampa, visited. I got to hold the actual Star Child skull for the first time and look in those eyes. And I said, this, you can't hold this skull and look in those eyes and think anything, but this is not human. It's just an eerie, odd, yet profound feeling to look into those eyes. After presenting to the team the plan that I saw we needed to do to bring the project to fruition, they voted me on as the chief operating officer. They said, you're a full-fledged member of the team. I was honored. And we've taken things since about this one-year period of time to where we're finally ready to start the fundraising that's necessary to legitimately raise the money to sequence the entire DNA. That's how I came on board. If you like, I'll be happy to elaborate on the history of the skull itself for those who may not be familiar with it.
Absolutely. Let's start. And by the way, let me just say this. When I first heard about the Star Child Project years ago, that is exactly what came to my mind. It's like, what are we waiting for? But the amount of money that's required to do the DNA sequencing and all the genetic testing must be enormous. So I thought there should be a fundraising effort of gargantuan proportions. So I'm glad that with your savvy business background, you're on board to help in that regard. But yes, tell us right from the beginning, how did all of this start?
Absolutely. Let's do that. And I'd love today to let your audience know exactly where we are in the fundraising, because it allows everybody to be part of the history I'm about to explain and to literally be part of it, to say that we are the first group of people, the public, not necessarily the government, which probably knows things that, you know, many of your listeners probably believe the government knows something, but no one in the public has a skull like this. And this one skull literally can change human history. So the history goes all the way back to the 1930s, where a young teenage girl was brought from Texas to Mexico with her parents to visit her hometown of origin, basically where her parents came from. This was in the Copper Canyon region of Mexico. It's about 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua. And actually, I was just listening to the audiobook of Carlos Castaneda the other night, and it turned out the places that he was going when he was experimenting with peyote and studying with Don Juan actually was in that exact area, which I found fascinating. Anyway, this young girl, teenage girl, was there with her parents, and the first thing she really was told was the mine tunnels and the caves up in the mountains are strictly forbidden. And as the story always goes, and it gets a little laugh, people say, well, but being a teenage girl, the first thing she's going to do, of course, is go up into the mine tunnels, into the caves. So
I would have done exactly the same thing.
Oh, me too. You know how exciting that would have been. But imagine what she found. And even if people like yourself have heard this story before, it's amazing to think of this story again. This young woman, about 14, so I went on her, who's a woman, not necessarily a girl, she walks up into the mountain. She takes a basket with her, pretending that she's just going out looking for fruits and whatnot. She walks into the entrance of a mine tunnel, and far enough in where she could see where there was still some light, there was a skeleton lying on the ground, which was a normal female skeleton. Yet next to it was a mound of dirt. Sticking out of the mound of dirt and wrapped around the upper arm bone of the female skeleton was what she later called a misshapen hand. She dug away at the dirt, and if you think about the imagery again of this, it's a mine tunnel. It was far enough in where rain and weather hadn't worn away at the soil or touched the two skeletons that were there in any way. So she's able to use her hands to clear away the dirt, and she found what she called a misshapen skeleton with a skull that was clearly different. It's hard to know exactly what her words were. We don't have a lot of her description. Yet she said the being was smaller, clearly smaller, than the female skeleton next to it. She didn't know, of course, it was a female skeleton. Later testing has shown that clearly the female found next to it is indeed female. And yet there was this other being, smaller, lighter, very different. She actually was able to gather all of the bones and didn't know what to do with them. So she went down into an arroyo, kind of a ravine where the waters run through, and she hid them in a relatively good spot, you would think, underneath the roots of a tree that was growing off an embankment. And she goes back to the local village with her family, yet 3 days of torrential rains came through and washed away all of the bones. So she goes back and, of course, must have felt horrible, but she kept walking downstream looking, hoping to find something. She found the two skulls, fortunately, the female skull, which we call the companion skull, and she found the skull that we now call the Starchild skull. So again, for any of your listeners who aren't familiar, at starchildproject.com, we have this complete history written out. When she was also able to find the upper right maxilla, the upper right jawbone of what we call the Starchild skull. She held on to these till almost the end of her life, when she was diagnosed with a terminal illness. And back in Texas, where she lived, where she had taken the skulls, she asked some friends if they would just take these odd skulls and kind of weird things to give to somebody, but she was dying, so they said, okay, sure, we'll take them. After a period of time, I believe it was about 5 years, they said, you know, we don't want these anymore. So they gave them to a couple named Ray and Melanie Young. And Melanie at the time, was a neonatal nurse. she held the Starchild skull in her hand and noticed what we all notice immediately. It's incredibly light, incredibly strong, incredibly symmetrical, and it's just, she said, with all of her years of working with human deformities in a neonatal ICU unit, she said, this is not a human deformity. She started asking around and eventually came across Lloyd Pye, who is a major researcher in the fields of alternative knowledge, and he was really looking into the phenomena of Bigfoot and Yeti and Sasquatch, and he is an expert in human origins and human skulls. So she asked Lloyd, found out about Lloyd, and said, can you figure out what this is? Because he knew if he ever found a Bigfoot, he had a whole protocol already lined up of what to do. She had Lloyd begin a journey, or Lloyd accepted the journey, which started in 1999, is continuing up to this day, and I'll take a moment to let you jump in. But that's actually when the entire Starchild Project began. The rest of that 14-year history we can certainly talk about, but that leads us up to at least when mainstream science and even geneticists started looking at the skull. And one of the major people who looked at it that I'm currently speaking with and doing interviews with that we'll have out soon is a Dr. Ted Robinson, a cranial facial reconstructive surgeon, now retired. And up to this day, me just recently interviewing Dr. Robinson, I said, so after all these years with everything you know, do you believe this is human? And he said, Matthew, after all of these years, I still am convinced that this skull is not a human deformity, and it is not from a human being. To hear those words from somebody who actually held the skull, studied it with other medical professionals for 2 years, gave me so much more faith to be part of the project, to say, this is the real deal. So with that, I'll throw it back over to you.
And I think, and thank you for that background of the project. I think it's important to have professionals and medical doctors come on board. I think you have a geneticist working at the Starchild Project now, do you?
Yes, on his technical credentials and name, we keep behind the scenes, yet he is a PhD at a genetics lab that I'm not allowed to disclose at all, yet he... There's been DNA testing that's occurred throughout the years, and most of it, honestly, and, you know, it might sound biased coming from somebody who's on the Starchild Project team, but I am the new guy, and I'm very skeptical, honestly. And I can say the earlier testing that was done really was not only inconclusive, it was really just wrong. Our current, we'll call him geneticist, who's, and I only put that in quotes because we're really keeping his credentials and everything private at this point. It's really just to protect his professional status now until we can really show that this is clearly what it is. He's done enough research over a period of about 3 years. We have huge amounts of information that has been gathered, and he is completely convinced. And I emailed him the other day saying, you know, I need to know if I'm going to fully come on board with this and put myself out there, that you, as we call him our chief science officer, that you as our chief science officer, you know, a true person who works with genes in a genetics lab, that you believe to the depth of your being this is the real deal, that this is not human. And he said, Matthew, I would not have invested this many years, this much time, if I didn't think this was something other than human. So yes, we have a person who is completely qualified to sequence the entire genome. He's just sitting there waiting for myself and the other members on our team to raise the money, basically, to start the project going. What will happen on November the 21st is we'll be starting our first major campaign, which any of your listeners can go to starchildproject.com to donate to. And you'll see how to do that through our website. I encourage anybody, if you're listening, wait until November the 21st or after. And on the Starchild Project website, it'll show you a link of where to go. You're actually able to get some really nice perks for your donation. And we're going to finally, as a community, you know, as the public, as people, be able to get our geneticist what he needs to be able to sequence the entire DNA. And with the matter, this could happen within a matter of less than a year. And then, of course, there'll be verifiable results. Many other scientists will look at this evidence. They'll have to duplicate it as scientific method would require. And within a period, probably that period might be maybe a year or two, we will have shown, we have enough evidence now that I can say this with pretty solid conviction, we will show a genome that has never been seen on the planet before.
And this could be genetic evidence of another life form. And I'm so glad that you're bringing all these professionals and scientists to the team, because I also have people who are listening to us understand that you have to be skeptical. You have to face everything with a skeptic mind, because that's your filter. You know, many people say, hey, this could be hydrocephaly. This could be progeria. But you've already been able to debunk that, have you?
Absolutely. And if you go to, the best place to go is to the website directly. Go to the source, starchildproject.com. You'll see Dr. Ted Robinson, again, a craniofacial reconstructive surgeon who examined the skull. And we've gone through this. And I am just as skeptical as, honestly, any of the most diehard skeptics out there. I only have an open enough mind to say, wow, I've reviewed the evidence. So if you go to different websites or even Wikipedia right now at the time of this interview, it's saying things that are just not accurate. When you actually study the evidence, you see that medical professionals like Dr. Robinson and the geneticist who's posting the information on our site now, you can clearly see that things like hydrocephaly, progeria, cradle boarding, these are the three major things that are brought up. And I can go into detail on those if you want, yet I can tell you that every human deformity known to modern science at this point has been ruled out. And anybody who says that it's something as simple as hydrocephaly or cradle boarding or progeria, which is actually the closest thing, I have to tell you, I wrote an 18-page paper to the Star Child Project team, including our chief science officer, and I said, prove to me it's not progeria. If I'm going to invest all my time, energy, and money into getting this project to fruition, I need to know this is not a human deformity. And they have convinced me left and right, plus my own research in every way I could. And so the simple statement from my point of view, and then from, of course, every medical expert that we've legitimately talked to, people have, I actually met with a neurosurgeon in South Florida quite recently, and he didn't want to go public. I never heard back from him again, but I actually showed him the replica copies we have of the skull and x-rays, CAT scans, and I said, have you ever seen anything like this? He said, no. I said, could this be the result of a human deformity? No. And this is an actual neurosurgeon who literally opens people's skulls and looks at their brains. And I said, is this hydrocephalic? He said, absolutely not. I said, could it be cradle boarded? No. I said, is this progeria? No. I said, have you ever seen anything like this in all your years of medical study? He said, no. And I said, would you go public with this? He said, no. So there's a lot of people who have examined the skull who have gone public with it. But either way, we have ruled out every possible deformity that's known. And if there's something out there, by the way, if somebody's listening and can legitimately say, oh, I know what this is, please email the Star Child Project team. We want the truth. If this turns out to be some incredibly interesting human, how it survived with this many differences, Dr. Ted Robinson, who's I've mentioned many times and who's really still helping the team to this day, when he examined it back in 1999 with his colleagues, they were looking at standard deviations from the norm. So even a human deformity, if the norm was, let's say, zero on a bell curve right in the center, a human deformity could be 1 or 2 degrees off of the norm. And yet the person would still survive, and of course they would not look, you would say, quote, normal. However, when they looked at the Star Child Project under the same scrutiny, looking at multiple points on the skull, they saw it was 10 standard deviations from the norm. When you look at that and you look at the genetic evidence that we currently have, this skull is so far from the norm, it really shouldn't have survived. So even if it is human, modern science should be all over this saying, how could something with this wide a range of physical anomalies and genetic anomalies have survived? The truth is, those who have studied it, that I've talked to, really don't believe that it was human, and that's what gets us so excited about it.
So you came on board from the perspective of a skeptic. And I like that, because here on this show, we don't want to believe. We want to know. And we have to be skeptical and then analyze the evidence and come to the conclusions. But, you know, a few things that I learned in preparation for today's interview. I didn't know that the girl who found the skulls had actually found the skeleton. Did she find both full skeletons? And then when she moved them, perhaps the water from the creek took them with them?
Exactly, yes. People, whenever I've done an interview, which I'm relatively new at talking about this, but anytime I talk about this on the radio or just share this with somebody, they always ask, well, can we go back and find the bones? Because, yes, the answer to your question is that she found the entire female skeleton, which was completely human, and most likely just an indigenous native of that region. And she found the entire Star Child skeleton somewhere in the Copper Canyon region of Mexico. And I don't think we'll ever be able to find it. All of the other bones actually do exist. But we're blessed to have not only the Star Child skull, the actual skull itself, very safely locked away, but we also have the female companion skull that was next to it. And we use it for comparisons when different scientific studies are done, because they're both carbon dated at 900 years old. So we can say, okay, here's the Star Child skull. It's approximately three times as thin. It's the estimate, depending on how you measure strength, is about three times as strong. And I can go on and on about the physical anomalies. But when you compare it to a human skull that was found right next to it, it's so radically different that it'd be wonderful to have the whole skeletons. The girl did find the skeletons, but all we have now are the two skulls and the one upper right piece of jawbone. And we had, originally there were three teeth. One of them was unfortunately sacrificed for genetic testing, which is a whole story in and of itself.
So both skeletons, because of carbon-14 testing, proved that that both skeletons existed at the same time. It wasn't that the woman found the Star Child skull hundreds of years later. And the question that I have in my mind is, I believe you mentioned that the Star Child skull is not human. I mean, the maternal and the paternal are not human. Therefore, what was the woman doing there with the Star Child? Was she a caretaker? I know we're just speculating here.
Certainly. And a lot of the questions can go to speculation. So I'm glad you've acknowledged the importance of being skeptical. And when are we talking hardcore science? When are we talking about an expert's opinion who's absolutely factual? And when are we speculating? The speculation on this is fascinating, because part of the Star Child Project's goal is not only to sequence the entire genome, yet to make a movie of this backstory. And even the Star Child book, which is on the StarChildProject.com website, it goes into that story. And as Lloyd Pye was writing in it, he did talk about a possibility of what the relationship could have been between this woman and this being. Yet if you think about what we do know, is they were found laying down side by side. The upper arm bone of the woman had the Star Child skull's hand wrapped around the arm. Now, the Star Child was buried in a very shallow grave. The woman wasn't buried. So the only way, if you think about it, and maybe there's other ways, so it is speculation, but if you really think about it, she would have had to carry this being up into the mine tunnel, buried it, wrapped its hand around her arm, and then she couldn't have just laid there for days to die. Most likely she committed suicide right there. So my guess is she was somehow some type of caretaker. The general feeling right now is, from all the genetic evidence, not just an intuitive feeling, but the genetic evidence shows that most likely there's no way that she was the mother. Now, if we get into the concept of alien hybridization, we can talk about that if you want to, but generally, we assume that she's, from the genetic research, that she's not the mother, but that she clearly cared for this being in a very deep way, and this being lived for many years on this planet. We have the evidence in the teeth that showed it actually ate food. It did have teeth, meaning we can see that it clearly was chewing food. So it probably lived at least with her, if not with maybe a community. But again, all this is speculation. Yet when you think about it, your mind can go wild with, what was this being doing in the planet? I will sit and hold. I actually have one of the replica copies of the skull right here in front of me. And I would just sit here and hold it and look at it and put it about 4 feet high, which is about how tall we thought this being was. And just think about it walking around on the planet and walking around with another human being and obviously not looking like a human. And yet it did. It lived in Mexico 900 years ago. Yeah, we can only speculate, but the more your mind thinks, you know, once if you go to the website and learn about the history of this, and then kind of just say, well, what could have happened? What could have their relationship been like? That's what's going to lead to what we want to do is create a full-length feature film that goes into that, because that part of the story, to me, is definitely fascinating.
It is fascinating indeed, and I thought, for some reason, I was under the impression that because there was a human female next to the Star Child skull, that that could have been the mother, therefore, making this Star Child a hybrid. But some tests have been conducted. Can you go into the testing now that proved that this, the maternal and paternal, were not related, humans were not related to the Star Child?
Certainly. And let me go into that by saying, of course, I'm not a geneticist, yet I went into this with a very skeptical mind, and I did my research. So whenever you see somebody do a blog post or even some what's on Wikipedia, which is highly outdated and wrong, I really did my research. There was research done in 1999 that, let's just say for simplicity's sake right now, is completely inconclusive and can't be trusted. There was work done in 2003 which was able to recover the mitochondrial DNA, which would mean the mother side of the Star Child's genome. In the female skull, where they went to do that, they were able to pull the maternal and the paternal, or the nuclear DNA, and they were clearly able to see this woman belongs to a certain haplogroup, which basically, simply stated, means that you can tell where she lived and the differences in her genetic structure. When you looked at the Star Child from that testing that happened in 2003, they were able to find what they thought was the mitochondrial DNA. And they found it was a different haplogroup, meaning there was something different about the structure, but it was still possible that those genes, and it's possible it's just contamination from someone else who is there, or held the skull. Anyway, the maternal or the mitochondrial DNA that was found then seemed to show that, yes, this was probably, at least the mother was human, but it most likely was not the woman who was found next to it. After six repeated attempts, even though they could get the nuclear DNA from the female skull, they couldn't get it from the Star Child skull, which is very interesting in and of itself. To answer your question further now, with the new chief science officer who's on our team, who's working directly with Star Child DNA and ruling out contamination and looking at what do we know, I started having to understand a bit more about haplogroups and mitochondrial and nuclear DNA, and it's very complex, so we won't go into all the details. Yet the conclusion now, when you actually look, you can see the mitochondrial DNA that we've been able to pull out so far. Not only does it not fall into any of the human haplogroups, meaning that it's just not the, well, simply stated, the mother is not female. When we sent that information into the National Institute of Health, which is where all of the genetic data is pretty much stored from every species that ever been sequenced, what came back was no known similarity. When we've managed to finally pull some of the nuclear DNA, which would come from, the nuclear DNA has the mother and the father. Yet when we were able to pull that, we found a sequence called the FOXP2 gene. And of, I believe, there's 211 base pairs in what we were able to pull, 56 of those are different from human. If you have one mistake, one genetic mutation in that gene, you might survive. Two, you're probably not going to survive birth. This being has 56 out of 211, which means approximate 25% of what we found is not human. So on the nuclear side, or you could say the paternal side, which you could just say is the father for simplicity's sake, is not human and couldn't have survived as a human from if it had a genome like that or a sequence like that. The mitochondrial DNA coming from the mother also has shown to be completely different from what we were originally assuming. So when you read some of the literature that's out there, from about 2003 to 2010 or 11, we thought it was possibly, you know, the speculation or the team thought it was an alien-human hybrid. Now the only thing we're really saying is the DNA shows that not the mother wasn't human, the father wasn't human, and we don't know what it is. We're really not walking around saying it's an alien anymore. We're just saying, I need to know what this is, and the only way to do that is to sequence the entire genome. So I hope that wasn't too complex, but the simple answer is yes, both the mitochondrial and the nuclear DNA has shown that the mother and the father at this stage of understanding are not human.
Now, that's a great explanation for the layman. Have other similar skulls been found in Mexico or anywhere around the world? And the reason why I ask, some people may say, well, could this be related? And I don't think I've seen elongated skulls. They're absolutely different. And, you know, you can see them in South America, Central America. Any correlation here between elongated skulls and this?
Not at all, actually. As far as I know, and I believe anybody who does their research, and we would like to know, if somebody else knows about a skull that is like this skull, please go to our website, starchildproject.com. You'll see our email address where you can contact us and let us know. But to this date, and this is, you know, a good 14 years now, nobody has ever been able to show a skull that is like this. Referring to the skulls you are, like the elongated skulls found in Peru, but actually all over the world, that's what Lloyd Pye, who is, of course, the major part of the Star Child Project team, or is major part of the Star Child Project team, he really believes that those are different species that someday will be proven to be what they are. Their DNA is harder to sequence. It's much more degraded than the Star Child skull. The Star Child skull actually has viable DNA that can be sequenced, but as far as the physical anomalies of this skull compared to anything that's been shown on the planet, including pictures if you look at a hydrocephalic skull, meaning there was water in the brain, it expanded the skull, and this would be of a normal human being. You can see images of those skulls online, completely different from the Star Child skull, where a hydrocephalic skull is clearly human, it just has an expanded head, basically, but everything else is really the same. You look at the elongated skulls, or even skulls that have been bound in their heads, just a human skull that was bound, nothing is like this. And the biggest thing, and nobody can do this unless you actually get to hold a human skull like we have, the female skull, and the Star Child skull, you hold them side by side, you know, in one hand, and each in one hand. And the weight difference alone is phenomenal, but the cranial capacity, when you talk about elongation, is significant. The female skull is 1,200 cc's. You can easily measure that. The Star Child skull is 1,600 cc's. My head, your head, is probably about 1,400 cc's. It's not impossible for a human being to have a head as big as 1,600 cc's, yet it's really one of the profound things to say, how did it have such a big head when there was, which was clearly filled with brain? We have the brain cast to prove that. Its brain was that big. When you elongate a skull through like human binding, and I believe the skulls that we see in Peru aren't necessarily the result of just human binding, yet when you bind a human skull, you don't expand the size of the brain. Those skulls wouldn't show the brains of the vein inside of it. The Star Child skull, actually, you can see where the veins were running on the inside of the skull, which also is one of the ways we rule out hydrocephaly, meaning water in the brain. In that condition, you don't see the veins on the inside of the skull. So, no, again, simple answer to this question. There's not a single skull on the planet that anyone has ever showed us that is like the Star Child skull.
And I'm glad you're discussing the elongated skulls. That's another fascinating story for another show. But, you know, there's a lot of proof about that. A lot of skulls have been found, some that were not man-made, if you will. They were not bound by man, but the speculation is that perhaps a different race, you know, they were perceived as demigods before, and the people wanted to emulate them, and that's when they started manually binding the skulls. But, you know, that's another story. But with the Star Child, what are the main differences between a human skull and the Star Child skull?
Certainly. So one of the first things you notice right away, and you notice this actually in the X-rays, and you can't, and you can see this on the website, again, starchildproject.com, if a person searches around enough, you'll be able to see X-rays of the skull. And when you see a human being, a normal human being without any deformities, you will see frontal sinuses. There's basically sinuses right there behind your brow ridges. In the Star Child skull, they're completely absent. If it was a deformity, there might be some vestige. Now, through my research, I have found out that some human beings supposedly completely lack frontal sinuses. So it is possible to be a normal human being and not have frontal sinuses, but that's the major thing you see right away in the skull, is there are no frontal sinuses. Now, a lot of people believe sinuses are the things that are there for when you get sick. The truth is sinuses are there to resonate your voice. So when you start thinking about what is this being, and again, we'll talk about many of the different anomalies that make it different than human, it didn't have an ability to resonate its voice the way that you and I can do because we have sinuses. So those are just gone, not even the tiniest hint of it. When I showed that to a neurosurgeon recently, again, who wouldn't go public about this, he said it's not unheard of, but it is extremely rare to not have frontal sinuses. And this helps to explain for some, but not all, of why or how the brain inside of the Star Child skull could be that big. There just isn't that extra space being filled up. Another real simple difference that anybody who's listening now could feel is what's called the occipital external protuberance, or simply your inion. And to make that really simple, if you just feel in the back of your head, if you trace up your neck, you'll feel a little bony structure that extends off. And every human being, anybody who has a neck, and including hydrocephalic infants, or anybody now who had hydrocephaly, medical techniques can get them beyond that. Yet, even in hydrocephaly, even in progeria, even in cradle boarding, you will feel the inion, the bump in the back of your head. On the Star Child skull, it's completely absent, which is just mind-blowing in and of itself. You just take that one concept that is there. Basically, the bigger a bone area is, like for instance, at the end of your elbow, at the end of by your wrist, you have large protuberances, and those are where muscles attach to. The Star Child skull, when we look at the pictures of how the muscles must have connected, it had actually extremely small muscles that had held this relatively large head to what appears to be, and if you look at this in what's called the foramen magnum, or the hole where the spine enters into the skull itself, you see an extremely small neck with extremely small muscles holding a head that is technically, by volume of brain capacity, bigger than yours or mine. Even though when you hold it in your hand, it appears to be smaller. It's this huge brain with this, with really no inion on the back. What we found is when we looked at the center of balance between a normal human skull and the Star Child skull, the center balance in a human skull is further back in the sense that you have so much face in front of where your spine is, right? You have a nose and a mouth and a chin and all your teeth and your eyes and your sinuses and a lot of brain up there in the front. And therefore, when you see where the center line is, there's a lot in front of that center line. In the Star Child skull, it's more like imagining a golf ball tee with the golf ball sitting directly on top. The foramen magnum is basically directly in the center of the skull. It's another very unique anomaly that said it's not a human deformity that made it do this. Its genes told it to do this. Like whatever this being is, grew this way. Its genes said grow this way. And again, if it was a human deformity, it wouldn't necessarily be so perfect in the way it's designed. A major aspect of deformity is asymmetry. When you look at almost, if you go through Google Images and you look at human deformities, you will see the major issue that occurs is asymmetry, where one eye is going to be higher than another. And if you look at progeria, which is one of the major things that people tend to mention, if you look at the teeth, and we have a fabulous section on our website now, it's a completely new website, you can check out starchildproject.com, there's a section that goes into the deformities. And if you look at progeria, you'll see a picture we posted of the teeth of someone who had progeria, and they are incredibly deformed. There's actually, you can just see all the teeth have pushed together. The star child skull, we can actually see its upper right maxilla, and we can do a mirror image so we can see exactly what it looked like. Its eyes, its head shape, the being is remarkably symmetrical, and that's another one of, so I've listed, I think, about four of what we acknowledge about 25 different physical anomalies that just from the physical examination tell you, this doesn't look human.
How about ears, eye sockets?
Sure. The eyes, both of these are fascinating. The ears are simpler to talk about. We'll start there. The CAT scans, and we've had this verified by many different medical doctors, we don't know about outer ears. We only have the skull. So any artist renditions, yes. It's important to acknowledge that any artist rendition is complete speculation that it had outer ears. The inner ears, we know, because we can see this in the bone, are twice as large as human inner ears. Nobody can really explain that to us. But as far as the ears go, as far as another major difference, if you had something like water on the brain, hydrocephaly or progeria, or if the skull was cradle-boarded or any other type of deformity that's been mentioned, you wouldn't have all of these different anomalies. Plus, why would you have inner ears that are twice as big? One of the theories is that our ears have a lot to do not just with hearing, but with the ability for balance. And when you have a head this big and a neck and a body that was probably very, very small, then the concept is the inner ear most likely had a lot to do with helping the being to balance itself. The eyes are fascinating. The first thing I would say about the eyes is, for anyone who's listening, if you've never looked into this, you can check it out online. Just look at the skull from an intuitive perspective, not even, talking the anatomy of it. When you look into those eyes, I had a web designer who was here recently when we were talking about amping up the Star Child Project and getting more new life back into it and raising the funds. And I said, can you help us? And he's not the one who did the new amazing website we have up now. Yet, when he looked at the picture, his first thing was, Matthew, this is inhuman. I can just tell by looking at the eyes. So that's just the first thing, is to trust one's kind of intuition. However, science doesn't allow for that. So when you start looking at the eyes, it's a complete redesign. It starts with the brow ridges. The star child skull doesn't have brow ridges. So any primate, including humans, if we want to put ourselves in that category, and I know your listeners might not put humans in the direct evolutionary line. Yet if you feel your own brow ridges where your eyebrows are, you have those. And not only are they there, but if you feel over them where they roll in towards your eyeball, it's kind of like feeling around a drinking straw. They're rounded. Not only does a star child skull not have brow ridges, which you can clearly see in x-rays and the CAT scans, they're just not there. But it's not a smooth ridge, it's actually a sharp edge. Not sharp enough that it will cut your finger, but when I sit here like I am right now, I can walk over and rub my finger over the top of the bone. It does not feel anywhere near like what I can feel on my own head. But then when you start getting inside, you notice the eyes themselves are, it depends on where you measure it from, but they're about, our eye sockets are about 2 inches deep approximately. The star child skull measuring from the same spot is only about a half an inch deep. So you're talking about very, very, very shallow eye sockets. Now, we had another brain specialist. Her name is not known to me. We're trying to find her again, actually. She looked at the skull and the eyes, and she looked at the brain casts we have. And she said, if it had eyes like this, and if and she looked at where the musculature was, and she said, this is a complete redesign of the eye. The way the muscles attach is not right. The way the optic forum and the places that the nerves and blood vessels go from the eye into the brain. Again, if you look on our website, you'll see a complete redesign of, if that's the right word, but a completely different design of the star child skull compared to human. When this scientist looked at at the eyes and she saw the amount of information that would be coming in, she said this must have an enormous visual cortex. And then she held the brain cast, turned it over, and sure enough, she confirmed in the area of the brain where all of this information should be processed, it matched what she saw in these eyes. So you can look at the difference in the optic foramen, the brow ridges, the shape, the depth, and the more you look, again, there's probably 10 different features you can mention about the eyes that show different from normal human.
You mentioned other scientists and researchers that are taking part of this, the research, and they're doing it anonymously. Why don't they go public? It's sad to see that in the United States, that's the way it is. Take China, for example. I know there are hundreds and hundreds of scientists looking at extraterrestrial life with the seriousness and the professionalism that this topic deserves. Not the case here. You are a professional, yet you took the proverbial dive. Why are others not as brave as you? Why are they fearing? Is it ridicule, professional suicide? What is it?
I think it's many different things, but I'll speak personally on that for just a moment. I have to admit, being a professional who runs multiple businesses with a very good reputation in my field, part of it is that I am, that I am financially secure. I run my own business, and I'm willing to, and now, actually, the picture that you received, to be honest, is the first time that I let a picture of me holding the Star Child skull go public. And then one of our teammates said, she didn't even know, she said, do you have more of these? And I'm like, let me give some thought.
Oh, good for you.
So, you know, honestly, it's fear that would hold me back from going public. Yet, for those of our listeners who are here, if they thought about it for a moment, you know, if you put your name on this, now, for many years, first of all, I think it's fair to say to professionals who looked, they didn't want to be associated with anything that's alien. You know, and just to put your name with that, with your peers, your colleagues, or your ability to keep your tenure, you know, that's dangerous water for some people. The new way that we're presenting this, it's not that it rules out something alien, but also, you know, we define what does that term mean. We're definitely not saying it's a gray alien anymore. We're just saying we need to know, you know, what is the truth here? And hopefully that's going to help more people be willing to say, yeah, I'll put my name on this because these people are legitimate. They're just trying to find through scientific method what is this skull. And right now, to me, it's, and to many people, it's still a mystery. The answer is not in. Yet I know when I talked to a physician recently and I said, can you help me with this? He had connections to a local college here. And I said, please, you know, help to get me in and I'll do lectures there. Not a single person from that college came back to me on that. And he actually introduced me to this neurosurgeon who wouldn't respond to my emails after the first time of looking at it. I think people, and including, and with all respect to our personal chief science officer, whose name is still not disclosed, he knows that if he puts his name out there right now, he could very easily lose his position as in a very distinguished genetics lab. So I think people are afraid of losing their jobs. They're afraid of ridicule. They're afraid of their life changing. And I can be honest with you, I'm the owner of a hypnotherapy school, and I practice hypnotherapy. I believe very strongly in it. When I just came on board with this project, I literally went and had some hypnotherapy sessions to clear my own fear, because not only was I opening up to the possibility of, what if this is an alien? You know, what if I have the skull of an alien? What does that mean? Am I going to be abducted? And then, of course, walking down the street, this is one of the most precious, valuable things on the planet, if it is what it is. You know, so that was a whole level of it. And then, of course, professional reputation. I can tell you this, the fear around this whole topic for a lot of people, including family and friends of mine who just, and, you know, students of mine that I'll talk to, they don't even necessarily want to talk about it sometimes. And so I would say underneath all of it is primarily fear that keeps people from taking action. What we're working to do now, the way it worked in the past, the Star Child team was looking for one person who would donate. We really honestly need, and I can explain why, we need about $7 million to sequence the whole genome and to document it properly. Through all the years, and this invitation is still open, Lloyd Pye, who's doing a lot of the lecturing, was asking for one investor. And it never panned out. When I came on board, I said, you know, I know you guys are not in this for the money. You're really in this for the right reasons. Yet we need to treat it like a business. It's like anything else. The Red Cross works to raise funds. So we want to raise funds. To do this, we need to tap into the power of the masses. So your listeners who are listening right now, at least 2 days from today, which would be November the 21st, we launch our first major campaign that people can see on our website, starchildproject.com, and then go to the actual place to make the proper donation that's going to go to the right place we want you to go to. When we get enough people simply donating $30 each, and that's all we're asking for is a $3 donation, a $12 donation, we're just looking to get a lot of people to make a very small contribution, whatever they can afford. And we have many different perks, different things you get for making the donation. By doing that, we'll be able to not have to rely upon any one person or any one scientist. We really don't need anymore one medical professional who will give their opinion or one scientist who will give their opinion. What we actually need is the power of every single person, everyone is listening now, who believes in UFOs or aliens or the paranormal or anything non-physical, otherworldly type experiences. If, like, we've been all wanting, so many people wanting proof of Bigfoot, but we don't have it. We want proof of aliens, we don't have it. What's so exciting for me is literally this one tiny skull, one little skull that was found 900 years ago, or that exists on the planet 900 years ago, can be the first time ever in our lifetimes. See, what I want for me, and I know what a lot of people on the Star Child Project team want, and I'm sure a lot of people listening, think about how amazing it would be that in our lifetime you get to say, I was alive like when they walked on the moon. I was alive when they first flew the first airplane. And in this case, I was alive when they first showed there was another species complete that looked like human, walked like human, but was not human. And to me, that does lean towards the concept of, yes, it could be another species, which you might call alien. But to be part of that history is profound. So what we're asking for people now in the new approach is basically, anybody who's listening, we're just asking for a small donation or just to go to Facebook and engage us, to like us, to subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's a whole new world now with crowdfunding and social media, where in 1999, when the project first started, they really didn't have the genetic, the DNA abilities, or the ability of what's called the crowd to reach a goal. Now we not only have a genetics lab waiting to sequence the entire genome, I mean, literally chomping at the bit, waiting for us to give them the money, but we now have what's called crowdfunding, and that at any moment anybody can make a donation, relatively small, but with the power of the masses, it's not hard to raise the type of money we need to raise. So it's really, it's at the cusp of, it's really ready to make history.
And I'm seeing enterprises all of a sudden pop up because of crowdfunding. And this could be a prime example of something that could revolutionize our paradigm. You know, like you, I'm a businessman. Sometimes I wonder if I weren't and I was looking for a job, I probably would be unemployable. All you need to do is Google my name and I'm associated with all this woo-woo. But because I'm independent when it comes to taking care of myself and my family, I spent many years in the corporate world. So people may say, all right, he's not a nut discussing these subjects. I hope that when people listen to you and I and others, that others can join us. Other people who are also people who have their professional expertise can join us and don't feel that they will be ridiculed. Because honestly, I don't care if I'm ridiculed when I'm here today, because I know there's a level of skepticism that's important in all of this. And you even wrote a very lengthy letter to Lloyd Pye and Company regarding, you know, what you thought was probably hydrocephaly. And also, I'm glad that you mentioned the figure, the $7 million, because I meant to ask you what the approximate or the exact figure of what you're looking for is so that the audience can know what you're shooting for. But when we come back, we have to take our one and only intermission. I want to ask you so many more things about the Starchild project. How many phases of DNA sequencing have taken place? What are some of the conclusions that you have seen so far? And also, I want you to paint a picture. Paint a picture if tomorrow, next month, next year, you're able to successfully obtain the funding necessary to reach the conclusion. If this skull is found not to have terrestrial origins, what would that do to the establishment? And I think this is another reason why institutions, academia, doesn't want to get involved, because they don't want to rock the boat. They want to keep the status quo, and it could be detrimental to their own operations. And those people who may be losing their jobs, they're looking at retirement. A professor who has tenure, they don't want to lose that. So I understand where they're coming from. But tell us once again, how can people donate to Starchild Project? How can they learn more?
Absolutely. Depending on the time of when someone's listening, the best thing to do is just to go right to the website, starchildproject.com, and then you'll see what our current crowdfunding campaign is. And then the best thing is to donate directly to the crowdfunding campaign. At any time, you can go to the website and make a donation. Yet the crowdfunding campaign involves the power of community, that when someone donates, we start getting higher up, and more people see it, and more people donate. It starts to have a exponential growth effect. So basically, to go to starchildproject.com and look for the most current crowdfunding campaign, and our next one actually is beginning on November the 21st.
Great. Folks, don't go anywhere. And I have another question that I'll ask you now, and I'll get the answer on the other side. I'm being brave by asking you this question. I'm not a geneticist, but I believe you need mitochondrial DNA in order to clone. Is there enough DNA to clone this call? We'll take the answer on the other side. This is Mel Fabregas, and you are listening to Veritas. I'm here with my special guest, Matthew Brownstein. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for listening to the first segment of this very important interview. To listen to the rest, go to veritasradio.com and subscribe. You will receive your login immediately. We'll take a short intermission, listen to some music, and we'll be right back. Enjoy.
This is Mark Passio, and you're listening to Veritas.